All right. Welcome, everyone. I'm Karen Von Hippel, the co-director of the PCR project at CSIS, along with Rick Barton, who apologizes for not being here today. We are hoping that this virtual meeting is a success. Previous attempts to use our technology have failed us. So we have we're hoping for an interesting discussion. We are going to talk about Pakistan's Directorate for Interior Services Intelligence, the ISI, today. It's hard to talk about Pakistan without hearing about the ISI and the role that they play, positive or negative, in terms of the extremism question in Pakistan and Afghanistan. There's been a lot of activity in the Fatah region in the last few weeks. And so today we are fortunate that we are going to get to the bottom of all of these allegations and speculation with our two speakers who are joining us on the line. The first speaker is Brigadier Shaka Qadir, who's joining us from Rawalpindi. Many of you may know him. He is a former Army and Air Force commander and faculty member of the Infantry School, the Command and Staff College, and the War Wing at the National Defense University. He's currently a visiting professor at Fatima Jinnah University and a regular columnist in Pakistan for the Daily Times. Also joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Dr. Hassan Abbas, who is a research fellow at the International Security Program at the Balfour Center at Harvard. He is a researcher focusing really on Pakistan's nuclear program and the AQ Khan story. He's a former government official in both the Bhutto and the Musharraf administrations and the author of a number of books. So we're really delighted to welcome both of our speakers. We've asked each of them to speak about three main issues. The first is the role of the ISI in Pakistan's security and counterterrorism strategy. The second is the ISI and its cooperation with U.S. intelligence. And then the third is the ISI and its role really in Pakistan in the past, the present, and the future, and the potential for civilian control of the ISI. So a lot of big questions, and each speaker will speak for 5 minutes, so they have a lot of time to fully address these issues. And then we have a number of people who will be joining us on the phone as well, so you'll hear a lot of beeping today. And after the speakers speak, we will open the floor for discussion. First, questions from the room, and then we'll take questions from those who are calling in. So it's going to be a little bit complicated. Please bear with me, and let's hope for the best. So please, Brigadier Qadir, would you like to start?
Yes, thank you very much. It's a privilege to be addressing such an August-October gathering, is it? Yes, an August-October gathering. I would like to really, you know, sort of jump in and take the bull by the horns and address the key question. And then perhaps let some of you pull your Patriot and cruise missiles and take me on the streets of Laredo or whatever. The key question, of course, is why are we here sitting discussing the ISI? We're not talking about the largest and most powerful intelligence organization in the world, which we know as a number of recorded rogue incidents to its credit. And we know that it has withheld information from its political leadership, which is, but we're not talking about the CIA. We're not talking about the Mossad, which is not the most powerful organization, but which is perhaps the most efficient. And which has no rogue operations to its credit, but it has all kinds of internationally illegal, successful operations to its credit. We're talking about the ISI, albeit the premier intelligence organization of an insignificant country like Pakistan, which most Americans wouldn't be able to find on the map. The question arises, why? Pakistan has only one really important role to play as far as the U.S. is concerned, which is its critical role in the war against terrorism. One can reasonably assume that we're talking about the ISI in the context of Pakistan's role in the war against terrorism. We can also see that apparently the war against terrorism isn't going quite the way the Americans expected it to go. And therefore the question arises, I assume, of course, that the audience has read through the two papers that I have written, which incidentally were written much before this offer to address what is today, and had nothing to do with this particular seminar that I gave. So, anyway, I assume that you have, therefore, what you have, you must have read the words in praise of this ISI, the boss of the CIA at that time, Bill Casey, had to say. So, what we are here to talk about, therefore, is it possible, is it perhaps possible, that the ISI is at least dragging its feet in this war? Or is it possible at the most that it is complicit and hand in glove with the terrorists in trying to defeat the American design? That perhaps is a crucial question that we are here to discuss. I suggest to you that perhaps the reason for this question to arise is because of the diametrically opposing views on either side of the Durham line. And in one of my articles, I have mentioned this also. I will reiterate that, expand upon it briefly, then give it to you, of course, to throw your missiles and take me on. From the Pakistani point of view, it seems quite clear that America is, if it hasn't lost the war in Afghanistan, it is on the verge of losing it. And therefore, from the Pakistani perspective, our western borders are becoming a source of threat to us. And the threat is increasing in direct proportion to the American failure. On the other side of the Durham line, the American, despite the fact that Admiral Mullen has admitted before Congress they seem to be losing the war, the American establishment is not prepared to accept that the all-powerful American military, with the all-powerful American intelligence system, the best in the world, could be defeated by a ragtag army of these handful of so-called terrorists. And because they cannot accept that, therefore, it seems to them that the most plausible that whatever unrest there is in Afghanistan is being exported to Pakistan. And because they have reached this conclusion, therefore, what should I do? If the ISI is actually as efficient an organization as they have said it is, as the CIA itself accepts it to be, if the ISI is that efficient, is it complicit or is it just dragging its feet? And I suggest to you that perhaps this is an unfair question, because if you sort of jumped from the fact that this problem is being created in Afghanistan and conclude from there that it is coming from Pakistan, and then go on to build up from that logic, then perhaps this is not quite the right way to look at it. I will end my comments here and leave it to you to take me on to answer questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Brigadier. Dr. Abbas, are you ready to come on?
Yes.
Great.
I am.
Please go ahead.
Again. Thank you. Thank you very much for this opportunity, and thank you to Brigadier Gadir for his insightful comments. I'll begin by saying that within the Pakistani state, in addition to the three important pillars of the state, which is, of course, executive, legislature, and judiciary, the Pakistani intelligence and media also emerged as two important pillars of the state in the last 15-20 years. So, of course, these five pillars created some kind of an imbalance also. But intelligence services, and especially inter-services intelligence, ISI, is a very important and key institution in Pakistan today. Yes, there are controversies about its past, some legitimate, some exaggerated. I know of many cases where many of things within Pakistan were blamed on ISI, whereas those were a product of different circumstances. Different players were behind those. So, and I don't know of any intelligence agency in the world which has any good reputation, of course, but the ISI within Pakistan was criticized regularly for its interference in politics. And there is, from where I will start, there is no doubt that in 1990s, the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence, especially its internal wing, acted in ways that damaged democracy. But it was perhaps at the behest of military at one stage. At another stage, even civilian presidents used the ISI for destabilizing political forces. As late as 2002, when the last, previous to this February 18, 2008 elections, when ISI was used in creating King's Party, a party for General Musharraf. political players who had very little support or who were discredited were collected, mushroomed or sponsored into a new political force for General Musharraf, and this is widely known and this is widely accepted and recognized and widely reported fact. Even one of the former generals who played a role in it gave an interview. So that was then. But I also want to add that in this 2008 elections, there are neither any reports nor any signs that ISI created or played any negative role whatsoever. And that's a good omen that at least in this latest election, perhaps there is a change. And this change apparently was due to the decision at the very top from the army chief then and now, General Ashfaq Kiani, who had decided that ISI will not be involved in internal political affairs of Pakistan. And we saw that when solid and clear decision was taken, it was implemented. So what I'm inferring also is that ISI, contrary to some views, is not necessarily an independent, autonomous organization. When army chiefs take clear decisions, it matters. Those decisions are implemented. I would like to see, and I hope that this will be followed in a way that now when the Prime Minister of Pakistan or the President of Pakistan or the political leadership, elected leadership of the country will take decision about ISI in terms of no role to be played by ISI in internal politics, this would be followed. The selection of the new ISI chief is also very insightful, Reverend General Pasha. And I say this because the selection of ISI chief is in the domain of the Prime Minister of Pakistan. Mr. Yusuf Raza Gilani could have appointed anybody else, but it is well known that Mr. General Pasha is a professional soldier who also happens to be known to be very close to the present Army Chief, General Kiani. And it appears to me that in this case, this was a choice primarily made by General Kiani, that he picked up his DGMO, Director General of Military Operations, to be the next ISI chief, and military leadership accepted that, or perhaps civilian leadership gave this opportunity to the army chief to select his own man so that there is more coordination and if that he can really implement Pakistan's policy in this current battle against extremism or war on terror or whatever name or label we want to give what is happening in that region. So that is, I would say, another good sign. Lastly, in terms of cooperation with the United States, lately there have been some reports, some public, some not, that United States had conveyed very serious concerns to Pakistan about their perception about the ISI role in the Fatah region or in terms of our allegations that there had been some support for some Taliban or militant elements going into Afghanistan. What I'm hearing is that many of those concerns have not only been acknowledged by Pakistan but taken care of, and some important changes even within the ISI have been made. So overall, I see some positive trends in terms of more apparent civilian control, and that is the way forward. Unless there is more coordination between ISI and other intelligence organizations, for instance, Intelligence Bureau of Pakistan, also between some of the intelligence work of law enforcement organizations, unless ISI changes its direction completely and start focusing on developing human intelligence sources in Fatah, and in NWFP, where the crisis is becoming very, very serious, then they will be serious problems. So the coordination among different intelligence organizations is one issue. Accountability is another issue. In the last week, the ISI chief, new ISI chief, and other related organizations gave briefings to the parliamentarians. And now the ball is in the civilian court. If the political leadership of the country will give clear directions, will make all organizations accountable, and especially ISI, in terms of calling their chiefs or senior people for briefings in front of Pakistani parliament, that is the only way for more monitoring, for more accountability, and also for clear division of authority and power. That ISI, rather than allowing it to play a role, a negative role, like in 1990s, especially in reference to interference in politics, to stop that or halt that process, the only way is more cooperation and more trust building between the civilian and military leaderships. I, at this moment, see some positive signs and hope that that will happen. And with this, I'll close my initial remarks.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll have a number of questions for both speakers. Maybe I'll start out and ask about what both of you think the role the ISI and the Army have played in this recent fighting in the Fatah region with these Lashkars, the self-organized militias that have been fighting back with the fighting back against the Taliban with some support apparently from the Army. Do either of you have any comments to make about the role the ISI has played in recent weeks? Maybe Brigadier Qadir first?
All right, I will. Firstly, yes, the ISI has been active in this aspect. We've been in contact with a number of people in the frontier who are pro-government. You will be aware, of course, that in the last about 3 years or so, the traditional tribal elders who were pro-government tribal elders have all, not all, but bulk of them have been killed by the Taliban. And so there are a few of them left, but they have been in contact with them. There is a growing feeling amongst the tribal the people themselves. I am talking not from one person sitting in Rawalpindi, but as a person who knows exactly what's happening in the tribal areas. There is a growing animosity against the extremists in the tribal area, and therefore, with the exception of but one tribe, the Masood tribe, both the Waziris and the Romans raised lashkars, which have taken on the extremists with the support of the army, and they have decided to get rid of all the extremists in their midst, especially the foreigners in their midst. Incidentally, this was something that the Waziris tried to do last year as well, with considerable success in February 2007. But then in March, about 4th or 5th of March, the Americans attacked a village close to Mirali, where the Americans claimed 20 extremists were killed. The locals said that there were 23 people there, 12 children, 8 women, and 3 old men, one of them half blind. I tend to believe the locals because the locals have been accurately recording when the Americans only hit their own areas, and if areas which were known to be hiding extremists, they have stated that these were areas that were hiding extremists, and this was the person who was hiding extremists, and these 5 or 7 people who attempted to kill have been were extremists, more likely to be were foreigners. So that generally the information is correct. The ISI has played a role, the army has played a role. Unfortunately, one thing that the U.S. Forces don't seem to understand is that they have to step back a little. Some breathing space to Pakistan to be able to work on this. Infiltrating these terrorists is not the easiest of tasks. If you have to, there's the best example, for instance, I can pick up on is that of England and the IRA back in the 1980s, with IRA was bombing the streets of London, and the British decided to infiltrate the IRA. It took them a decade to do so. Now, today, these Taliban are very apprehensive of anybody trying to come into their forces. And to prove the credentials of any infiltrator who attempts to join them, to establish his credentials, he will have to commit acts of terrorism before he can be accepted as one. So, and that takes a lot of time. And it's a dirty game. Be played in its own way. But you have to step back a little and give us a little bit of breathing space to be able to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Abbas, do you want to comment?
Yes, briefly. I think what has really happened in Fatah has really transformed the area in so many different ways. For instance, the about 300 of the tribal leaders, the traditional tribal Maliks, were killed in those in that area. Also, the traditional leadership, the decision-making process, that area has been destroyed. And we, if we read Pakistani newspapers, every day there are news items that such and such person was beheaded because he was believed to be or perceived to be a U.S. spy. So these kind of beheadings are taking place every day. I don't think the political leadership or even the military and intelligence leadership was really following what was transpiring in the Fatah area. Now, by supporting some of the Lashkars, I think this will be a short-term policy, a temporary wajah, because unless there are long-term reforms, political reforms in Fatah region, or unless there is specific military action in certain areas, like now what is happening in Bajor, the intelligence organizations will not be able to really go in and change the dynamic in a short measure. I agree with Brigadier Qadir that there is no short-time solution or there are no quick fixes in this case. But we had seen in one case, Mullah Nazir, a person who was supported by the intelligence organizations or by the government for a while, who was able to get rid of some Uzbek militants in the area. But then again, we are not sure about the ideological leanings of people like Mullah Nazir. What happens if there are five Lashkars who at this time fight the Taliban and other militant groups and Al-Qaeda effectively, and later it turns out that they themselves are quite bigoted or their worldview is very similar to a religious extremist point of view. So these Lashkars and these manipulations in the past had never worked. Maybe for some time it will give an opportunity for the military and the civilian administration to go in, entrench them, establish the writ of the law. But the only role I see of Lashkars is a very short time action, giving opportunity to the state to really come in and take over. We cannot expect these Lashkars to win, even if they win some of the battles, to really take over and then act in ways which are very different than what the militant groups were doing.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Now we're going to take some questions from the room, and then I'll call on anyone who's calling in. So I think, please introduce yourself and speak into the microphone, Marvin, please.
Shaukat, Hassan and Marvin here. Good to talk to you both.
Thank you.
Hi, Marv. How are you doing, you old son of a gun?
Good. I had actually my first question, Hassan, in a way already has gotten to that. I was going to ask you whether this, what you're talking about here in terms of supporting the Lashkars, and isn't simply a matter of Pakistan's policy of containment, and therefore actually has very little to do with U.S. concerns are in the region, that is to halt infiltration. It's really in Pakistan's interest rather than, and I think Hassan was getting at it when he said that their worldview, their sympathy for the Taliban, Afghan Taliban, remains, and there's no reason to believe that any kind of arrangement won't do what we've seen in the past, and that is help support the infiltration. But I think the other question has to do with the fact that, Shaukat, you've in your Daily Times op-ed, made the very important observation that until you get a professional, civilianized ISI, we're really not going to get past the problems that we've seen with the ISI. And I think that that is such an important point. I don't know that anybody has really stressed it in the way you have. So my question is, okay, and of course, military intelligence exists aside from ISI and will continue to exist. But what are the chances now that what you want, Shaukat, can be implemented? Wouldn't it take a strong leader, a strong civilian leader, say someone on the order of Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, to be able to even try to do this, to wrest this away from them and to turn them into what they could have been initially, and that is simply a intelligence organization working on the behalf of the government and not the military?
Okay. Brigadier, would you like to go first?
Yes, I'll thank you very much for not taking up the cruise missile, which I was wondering whether you would or not. As usual, you'd be kind. I will take your second question first. I think, personally speaking, that there is no better opportunity than now, because with Ishaq Parvezkhani, the chief of the army staff, is sort of bending over backwards, trying to prove, to establish the civilian supremacy, the principle of civilian supremacy in the government. He's not only briefing himself operations, he's gone to the parliament to brief himself. The first time he briefed the prime minister, you know, in the past, it was the prime ministers who sort of come to the chief of the army staff, and GSQ would get briefed whenever they would, and it would be at the will of the chief of the army staff to decide that. But this time he offered to brief them, and he said, I will come to the prime minister's house and do so, which he did. So he's sort of been bending over backwards to establish this principle. And I think there is no better opportunity than now. And I think, like I said in my article, Ahmed Firyaz Pasha's tenure is perhaps the best opportunity, because he's got only about 10 months left before he retires from military service in terms of age, when he reaches the age of 57. And if they keep him on then as a civilian and then start civilianizing the ISI, perhaps that's the best thing to do. I wrote that with all, as you said, with full belief in the fact it's the best thing to do. It's the only way for Pakistan to move forward. Now to go back to your other question, the Lashkar. There is a difference between the approach that the Americans want and Pakistanis want. You see, the Americans, when they attack a place, they don't mind, for instance, and I'm stating records of what is almost factual, killing one militant to 10 collateral damages. Now, in Pakistan's case, one militant to 10 collateral damages means 10 families of potential terrorists. And as you know, Marv, in Pakistan, the concept of family is a very extended one. So they become, when you talk about one family becoming potential terrorists, you're talking about a large number of people. Now, this is an approach that the Americans are indifferent to. Pakistan cannot afford to be so. When you're asking me, I disagree with Hassan Abbas, with Dr. Hassan Abbas, with all respect. He's an academician and perhaps more knowledgeable than I, not perhaps, but almost certainly more knowledgeable than I. But I would submit that the Lashkars are perhaps the best way, because they come from within. I want to point out one additional fact to emphasize the point that I'm trying to make. And I think this was also somewhere in one of my articles, if not in these, somewhere else, one of the other articles. What is, you know, that the NWFP, the Pashtun portion of the NWFP, is almost entirely anti-American. But none of the other tribes have joined these three revolting tribes, the Masood, the Wadis, the Hovans. And the reason why they have not joined them is because the lack of the traditional leadership is throwing up the cleric. Now, the cleric in the traditional Pashtun class tribal structure is so far low down that there is a Pashto saying in Pashto in which a tribal elder is talking to a cleric and which roughly translates to something like this: I will not consider you less than a menial, but don't dare look upwards. What I'm trying to say is, because of the fact that the lack of the traditional leadership is throwing up clerics, the other tribes have no sympathy for these. And that's why the rest of the Pashtuns are not joining with them. Now, this is the opportunity that Pakistan wants, and I think that we can, if we work towards it, if you just give us a little bit of breathing space, if we work towards it, we establish a little bit of confidence in the Masoons, because these are the least confident of the lot. In the Masoons, they will themselves throw out their extremists. And I personally think this is the path to the future. These people have to get rid of their own elements. And they traditionally have always done so. There has been justice prevalent in their system. There has been an egalitarian system which beats out justice to all without any partiality, unlike most portions of the rest of Pakistan. So I personally feel this is perhaps the best way to go, and I'm not saying this with any excuse for the Pakistani government, but I think that the U.S. and Pakistan have the same aim in mind. It's just that we are looking at things slightly differently. If we can begin to find a meeting place, we can find to work together and get to where exactly where we want to. I hope that answers your question, Mark.
Thank you. Dr. Abbas, did you want to come in?
Yes. First, I'm thankful to Brigadier Kader for his kind comments. I've greatly learned from his articles. I agree with one point. He says that, yes, Lashkars can be a potentially an important factor. But what I meant was that if the Lashkars are instantaneous, natural, or they are developing from grassroots level on their own, and then they are facilitated by the intelligence or government, that, of course, would make a lot of sense. But if the intelligence services or army is expected to in any way choreograph and create or sponsor some new Lashkars, that would not be helpful, because that would do the same what happened in previous years. But if there is a sudden automatic or natural reaction from the people, and then that is facilitated, that would have much more credibility even in that area. A couple of other questions you raised, one about what Marvin also mentioned about the possibility of civilians becoming more active, or civilian professionals gaining control in some ways, if I may, of the ISI. I think that's a very crucial point. But the situation at this moment, perhaps, or till last few years, was that ISI is dominated by the armed forces personnel, primarily army officials. Some of the civilians who joined the ISI in the last 10-15 years were not given very crucial senior positions. There are limits to their promotion. They are analysts, yes, but even in their analysis, a person, just because he has a higher rank in uniform and has more stars on his shoulders, think their analysis is better than the civilian analyst's viewpoint. That kind of debate or division is there in ISI, and that needs to change also. The last point I want to make about what also Brigadier said about more time needed for Pakistani policy to be effective. And I'll just say in one sentence, we were ready to give General Musharraf 8 years to try all things, and then he messed up in a great fashion. Why are we not ready even to give 8 months to this civilian government? Why this huge discrepancy?
Great. Well, thank you. Now I'm going to see if this works, but I'd like to see if anybody who is on the line wants to ask a question, see if we create chaos. Anybody on the phone want to ask a question?
Yes, this is Rajesh Kadian.
I'm sorry, who's this? Yeah? Speak up, please.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Rajesh Kadian, and I'm on the phone, and I'm grateful to both Adair and Dr. Hassan Abbas for their comments. I'm not so hopeful that there's been a change per se, given that the DGMO, which is a key appointment in the Army, now becomes the ISI chief, and a former ISI chief, I think for the first time in the history of the Pakistan Army, is now the chief of the Army itself. And the former, and so that does not sound as if the ISI in any way is being, you know, the role of the ISI is in any way being reduced. I think it's being strengthened.
Okay, thank you. Do either of our speakers want to respond? Brigadier, would you like to respond?
No, I think that's a fair, I mean, it's entitled to his own point of view, and why not? That's a point of view.
Okay, what about Dr. Abbas?
I think I look at General Pasha's rise as ISI chief in a slightly different light, because he was DGMO and when Director General Military Operation, which traditionally the role played by DGMO is your external threats, what's happening on the Indian border, what's happening on the Afghanistan border. But he was involved in some of the internal military operations. So he, within the military hierarchy, he had a very fair amount of idea what is happening to military operations inside Pakistan. And because of his closeness to the army chief, this at least means that the military and ISI will work very closely. In the past, we have seen that army chiefs in early 1990s had a different orientation, and an ISI chief, like what happened in case of Lieutenant General Hamid Gul or Lieutenant General Nasir, that the army chiefs were different in orientation, and the ISI chiefs were making the ISI as a domain of their own. That is very unlikely to happen now, that the army chief and the ISI chief have common interests and have common viewpoint and are linked to each other strongly.
Okay. Questions?
Hello? Oh.
May I put in a word here?
Yes, please.
You must understand that the ISI does not fall under the army chief. Okay. In the Constitution, the ISI comes under the Prime Minister. It's not just that the Prime Minister appoints the Director General, the ISI reports directly to the Prime Minister. Unfortunately, in the past, why it was going wrong was because there were three-star officers, serving three-star officers, whose future was dependent upon the chief of the army staff, and they were going to serve only a couple of years in the DGISI. So, therefore, it was taken for granted that the DGISI would also report to the chief before reporting to the PM or after reporting to the PM either way. Now, this is what has to be changed. And that's why I suggested that perhaps a civilianized establishment in which the DGISI is totally independent of the chief can be the one that is workable. Thank you.
Thank
Hello?
You. Yes, please. Go ahead.
Yes, this is Gary Thomas from VOA News here in Washington. I'm wondering if there is any concern about ISI's use of contractors. I understand that more and more the ISI, indeed like the CIA, has been using contractors, pension-off case officers, who may be working in the field and therefore may not be subject to stringent controls as staff officers.
Okay. Brigadier, would you like to take that question?
Yeah, well, I'd like to begin with saying I don't know whether you put that into my introductory remarks or not, but I have never served in an intelligence organization, so I have absolutely no idea about any intelligence organization. I'm just speaking from the outside. You have to make do with me because you probably didn't get an insider. Now, my view is the point that the gentleman has made is valid. In the past, there have been people who were on the field, in the field, and they were aligned with the Taliban or with the Kashmir policy, and when Pakistan took a U-turn, and I said this, I think, in one of my articles, that when Pakistan took a U-turn on this policy, there was a problem with elements that were considered perhaps to be, which could be considered to be rogue elements. And there were. But today, I don't think there is any such concern. I think there was a purge that took place. The purge was necessitated. It was not by choice. Musharraf did not undertake that purge by choice at all. When 9/11 occurred, he was given no choice. He said, Bush said, you're either with us or against us. And he said, okay, I'm with you. And therefore, there was a U-turn on the policy of the Taliban. And then DGISI, Mahmood, was pro-Taliban. So the DG was chucked out. The new DG was sent in, Ahmad, who started the purge. And Ashfaq Ghani ended the purge. Because the next U-turn that we took was on our Kashmir policy, in which we decided in Musharraf's time, and this is the only thing I want to give credit to Musharraf for, was his change in the Kashmir policy, the fact that he decided that Pakistan will not support the militants in Kashmir any longer. So that purge took place, and I think it took place successfully. And I think we no longer have any elements to worry about. But this concern remains. I mean, this point remains. There may be people who are overlooked in this purge, who are out in the field, and you don't know, because we are contracting people out. The ISI has always and will continue to contract people out. And when they contract people, then sometimes you don't know where their affiliations lie.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Abbas, did you want to...
Yes. One issue is of credible information about the workings of the ISI. It's, I think, very interesting that there is not a single book, for instance, academic or journalistic, on ISI in the international market. Within Pakistan, there have been few books written in Urdu language, which were not of very good quality. There was one a book by Brigadier Tirmizi, I think, Profiles of Intelligence, that stands as the only book. So, and within the media in Pakistan, workings of the or doings of the ISI are not routinely described in many details. So there's always this issue of credible information about ISI, other than its reputation. Some of the Indian organizations have written on ISI, but I think many of those, or perhaps most of those, were quite exaggerated estimates. So there's this one big issue of lack of really credible, detailed information. But in case of contractors, I think even General Musharraf had acknowledged that in 2006, I believe, and I think that is absolutely true, that some of the former intelligence agents who were the handlers during the Afghan years, during the 1990s, when Pakistani ISI or other intelligence agencies had good working relationship with some of the sectarians, some of the religious militant groups, I think that's a fact. Some of the militant organizations or sectarian organizations which played havoc in Pakistan had some relationships with elements within the ISI. That was 1990s. Some of those handlers, when they were thrown out or purged from the intelligence services, I have not seen in even one case where a former intelligence official was questioned in Pakistan that who gave you these orders, why you were in touch with a certain militant organization. So perhaps, again, it's a matter of speculation that some of those former handlers had joined in as consultants with those religious or militant groups. I am not aware of the present situation. Apparently, those handlers are a talk of days gone by. And today, this whole issue of contractors is there. If Pakistani intelligence services have not been able to really profile some of the militant organizations who are doing all this, or in case what you had heard about the nuclear proliferation issues of Dr. A.Q. Khan, when he was in late or mid-1990s, if he was not, the ISI or the army was not able to track him and his activities. So we are. It makes sense that, yes, ISI committed mistakes in picking up its partners and its contractors. But that was possible in 1990s. Now the situation is such that even one mistake in picking up a wrong contractor can be fatal or can be very, very dangerous, especially in NWFP and the Fatah region.
Great. Well, thank you. Other questions? Phone or in the room? Yes, please.
I just want to say there's an excellent study which has been written about 8 months ago on the ISI. It's an article, and the author is Sean Gregory, and he can be Googled. It's a British journal. It's Strategic Studies Journal. I don't know the exact title, but you'll get it. I think that the assembled group here would find this very edifying. It's certainly the best thing I've read specifically. What did you think of it, Chaka?
I think it's a good study, but I think it's not quite objective. You know, everybody has their own little quirks about the way they think. When you start off by thinking that there is an intelligence organization that is liable to go off on its own, that is a country within a country, then perhaps some of the conclusions that you draw might not be quite correct. But it is a good study, and I think it's worth reading anyway.
Great.
Marv, it's nice to hear you.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, more questions, please? Becca, please come up to the front.
Hello, this is Becca Smith. I'm a junior staff member here at CSIS. I was wondering about anti-Americanism in the Fatah. I've heard that it's not as great as is portrayed, at least in the U.S. elections, that average Pakistanis understand that the United States needs to go into Pakistan to look for Osama bin Laden and to chase down Taliban elements, but that the tolerance for civilian casualties is zero, that especially where women and children are concerned, as soon as average Pakistanis see their people being killed, that the tolerance for the U.S. presence will evaporate. So if that is an accurate assessment, first of all, is that an accurate assessment? And if it is the U.S. presence effectively untenable, given the likelihood that you've already mentioned of collateral damage in U.S. attacks? That's my first question. And the second question is, on the topic of the 300 tribal leaders who have been killed, and the request simultaneously that I've heard from Pakistanis for the United States to back off and let the Pakistani government take care of governance here, is the Pakistani government capable of governance in these areas? And isn't there the likelihood of a power vacuum? What would happen if the United States was not there? Thank you.
Brigadier, you go ahead, please.
I didn't quite get the first question. What was the assessment? Could you repeat that for me, please?
The assessment being that anti-Americanism in Pakistan is not so high as portrayed and in the
front. But
that the more civilian casualties that there are, that there's a very short window maybe. The more there are civilian casualties, the less tolerance there will be across Pakistan for U.S. presence in Pakistan.
Yes, you're quite right. I think that the more civilian casualties that occur, the less patience there is in Pakistan for American intervention in Pakistan. There is a general feeling that the Americans are only concerned about American lives. When we talk about casualties that occur in, for instance, Iraq or Afghanistan, we only hear about how many American lives have been lost or how many lives of NATO soldiers have been lost. We don't hear about the hundreds and thousands of people, of Iraqi people and Afghani people who have died in the process. And we'd never hear about the number of people who have died or have been injured in the attacks across the international border into Pakistan. Now, let me just explain with a small example. Take, for instance, a 500-pound bomb. If a 500-pound bomb explodes about, shall we say, about a kilometer away from a village, all children below the age of 4 will begin to bleed from their ears and noses. More than 60% of them will lose their hearing. These casualties are never even recorded. Now, how the hell do you think people feel about that? I mean, this is... how would any mother feel about that, or any father feel about that, or any brother feel about that? How would you feel about that if they were Americans? But Pakistan is an expendable, so that goes on. Your second question was with regard to... What was your second question?
The tribal leaders and the lack of governance.
Yeah. Yes, your question was actually whether the political leadership of Pakistan can muster the courage to take up this challenge. I'm afraid I cannot answer that question. I find that the political leadership of Pakistan at present seems quite rather less. But unfortunately, the political leadership...
Brigadier, are you there? Hello? We've lost you. Okay, Dr. Abbas, would you like to come in while we try to hopefully reconnect?
Yes, certainly. In terms of anti-American, or what I would frame as anti-U.S. sentiment, because the very word anti-Americanism has different connotations, I think the anti-U.S. sentiment within Pakistan is very strong. Even in liberal secular circles, even in among the intellectuals or people in urban areas, educated people, you'll find that all across the divide. The difference is that a secular or educated person is critical of some of the U.S. policies, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan or elsewhere, at an intellectual level, and that person may not, that cannot easily be translatable or translated into being a potential extremist or a terrorist. Whereas in the tribal areas, it's more about animosity, it is more about rivalry. I don't see things changing in the tribal areas. Yes, if in any drone attack, in any direct U.S. attack, Osama bin Laden or al-Zawahiri is taken out, I think there will be acceptance of that or acknowledgement of that, or people would be quiet knowing that those are the top targets of the U.S. government. But if in that those direct actions, we will never find who got killed, or even if the top leadership of Taliban or Al-Qaeda are not taken out in those attacks, then those attacks create more criticism or animosity even within the liberal educated circles of Pakistan. Is Brigadier back, or can I can take the second question?
Yes, I am. I'm virtually disconnected. I just wanted to complete what I was saying, which was that I'm not sure about the political leadership, whether they can actually take up this challenge or not. At the present moment, we seem quite rudderless. But the Americans have seemed rudderless for the last 12 years. And they were by, you, of course, are much better placed when they do accept you, the leaders of the world. And we are the third world country. Whether we can afford an unsuccessful political leadership or not is a question that is open to debate. I cannot answer this question whether the political leadership will be able to tackle this question, this situation. Or I think the army is presently quite prepared to do so. And I think they will probably push the political leadership a little towards that direction. Thank you.
Great. Dr. Abbas, did you want to answer the second question?
Yes, second question, I would argue that political leadership, I'm not talking about any specific party, but they inherently are more capable to tackle these issues. I think the very reason that we are facing this problem is because in the last 10, 12 years, some decisions were taken at the topmost level by General Musharraf. There was no political support base of those decisions. And because of that disconnect between the government and the people of Fatah, we are seeing what we are seeing today. Yes, the political leadership today, with members of the parliament, we have not seen in the last 8 months a lot of energy or enthusiasm for them to really go after this issue. But again, this issue of patience comes in. With the previous 10 years was a different ball game. I don't think of any other possibility but a cohesive political policy which can be pursued. Military options, the army chief, the army leadership, their actions will have a very limited capacity. Yes, in certain areas, some of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda leaders have to be tackled militarily. There is no doubt about it. I think this is acknowledged in Pakistan. But the long-term difference that can be made is through change of the frontier crimes regulations by perhaps incorporating FATA into the mainstream Pakistan. Those are all political decisions. Awami National Party, perhaps we may have much more capability and capacity to interact with the tribal leaders. So my hope is only with the political leadership. I think if they will fail to do it, then FATA is lost as far as Pakistan is concerned.
Great. Well, thank you. And we have time for one more question, which is coming from this room here. So please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Hummel. I'm at USAID's Office of Transition Initiatives. Wondering if we could put the difference here. Is there any hope of more civilian-military coordination, let's say in Bajor, where, you know, there is still a security challenges that, you know, the Frontier Corps or even the PACMIL need to address, but then there are humanitarian issues with internally displaced persons that the civilian side and the political agents will also need to address? Is there the prospect for better civil-military coordination where in the past that probably hasn't really existed?
Great. And let's not forget all the thousands of refugees that have now gone into Afghanistan. Okay, please go ahead, Brigadier Cutter, for your final comments.
Yes, I think there is certainly a lot more scope for that. I think the fact that the traditional political agents haven't been able to function as he used to be able to do is because of the lack of the traditional tribal leadership. But there has to be some method worked out in which there will be a political agent, a political representative, who will be able to work with the tribal leadership, which exists at the moment, whether it is a cleric or non-cleric, and they will work towards a peaceful settlement of the area. This has to be the future. The only word of caution I want to put in is when you see people from the outside begin to look at the tribal areas of Pakistan, the first thing that occurs to them is, for instance, education. And I think that certainly they're not wrong in the importance of that education. The only thing they don't realize is that when you're talking about an area where there is no potable drinking water, for one, and where each hand of the family has to work to find food, to put food on the table for two meals a day, two meals a day, then the father finds it very difficult to send his son off to school to waste time there when he needs it. So when you look at this area and when you look at reconstruction of this area, when you look at civilian interaction with the military and perhaps the long-term future possibilities of creating a peaceful region, perhaps you need to address the basics first before you move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Dr. Abbas, any final comments to this question or in general?
Yeah, just one liner sort of say that I think the Bajor operation, a success of or potential success of Pakistan military in the Bajor operation can really turn the tables on Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan. But what is happening in North and South Waziristan has different dynamics. So this battle, success in this battle, I think is very crucial for the Pakistan military. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'd like to thank both of our speakers, Dr. Abbas and Brigadier Cutter, for your patience and for your wisdom and expertise today. We're very grateful. This will be put online this evening, so if anybody wants to listen to the podcast, you're welcome to download it from our website. And thank you all for coming. Thanks to Mehlika Samdani, our expert advisor, who's helped us, and, of course, to the Soros and Carnegie Corporation for funding. So thanks, everybody.